Well, the federal government's national school lunch program now force feeds school kids healthy foods, which the school kids promptly throw into the garbage. This leads us to ask, who can feed children healthy food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 796th edition of the Food Chain Radio, right here on News Talk Radio. But hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Christchurch or tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Ricochet on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Folks, something about this story that we're going to work with today troubles me. Kind of feels like a beaver gnawing on my leg. Maybe I'm too sensitive, but give the stuff a listen here that we're going to be working with and see if a beaver gnaws on your leg as well. It has been said by a person in a position of great power that one should never let a serious crisis go to waste. We do have a serious crisis in that some 17% of our children are obese and another 20%, give or take, are overweight. To make certain this crisis does not go to waste, the federal government has instituted the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, which forces schools to feed children healthier and more nutritious lunches with less sodium, less trans fats, more whole grains, and a wider selection of fruits and vegetables. In addition to what kinds of food government will allow children to eat, it also has placed restrictions on how much food children may eat, with kindergartners being allowed 650 calories, 6th through 8th graders 700 calories, and high schoolers 850 calories. Having been led to the government's healthy, hunger-free kids' lunch, however, many kids are refusing to eat it, and the nation's garbage cans are rapidly filling up with healthy school lunches. Furthermore, those children that takes joy in burning calories with sports and outdoor activities are quickly running short of energy and going hungry. All those garbage cans filled with healthy food and all those hungry kids pleading for more calories lead us to ask some questions. Can one government program feed 36 million kids the right food? Why do children rebel against healthy school lunches? And finally, and perhaps most importantly, who can best feed children, government or parents? Here to help us cook up some answers, we have couple great people. Jamie Smith, Chef Jamie Smith.
Good morning.
Good to have you back.
Thanks.
City Schools Director, City of Santa Cruz, California. What does a City Schools Director do?
I'm the Food Services Director.
Food Services Director.
I make those school lunches that you are telling us that we're throwing in the
garbage. I have to ask, how the heck do you do that?
It's a little symphony of chaos every day. But it's a coordinated effort that we have. We have lots of great employees, the famous lunch ladies and hairnets with, you know, their spoodles serving up healthy lunches every day to the kids.
And they line up and pull all. How many lunches do you put together?
Every day we put about 2,100, something like that. Not too many. Yeah, it's not a lot.
It's not a lot. Kind of reminds me of the galley in an aircraft carrier where they're cranking all that food out. And you've got a program that you're feeding kids up to 5 meals a day now?
Yeah, two of our schools, we have 5 different opportunities for the kids to have a healthy meal every day. Breakfast before school, a second chance breakfast, a lunch, an after school snack, and a supper. Now, all of those are federally...
Yeah, that sounds like a place I would like to be, where there's 5 meals a day right there on my plate. I love that.
They can get 3 of them subsidized by the government, but they can choose at what, or sorry, 4 of them can be subsidized by the government. The 2 different breakfast periods are just 2 different opportunities. So technically we're looking at 4 that can be subsidized by government funds.
Well, also with us today, we have Jill Troderman, a nutritionist, a holistic nourishing nutrition. Tell us about your business.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Move up to that microphone. There you go.
Great. I work with families and children on nutritional issues. I have a clinic in SoCal that I have a private office at, and I do a lot of education in our local community.
Good. So here we have two people who really know about the subject today, and we should have some fun. So first question I'd like to come to grips with, can one government program feed 36 million kids the right food? Start that off. Do we really have an epidemic of obese kids, Jamie?
You know, I think we do. I think we do. I mean, I think a lot of people throw the word around a lot. It's become the word of choice right now for what we're talking about in school food, you know, the obesity epidemic. I'm not a huge fan. I think that what it leads to kind of shaming, and it shames the family. You have obviously done something wrong in raising your children. But it has to do with the kind of foods that we've allowed to enter into our food system. You know, it's a free market here in the United States, and, you know, they've allowed a lot of unhealthy, unnutritious foods to get processed and sent to our kids, both through the school lunch and also in you know, stores and supermarkets that have kind of been moved further and further away from the produce aisle to the frozen and the processed packaged food aisle. And, you know, it really is kind of on the shoulders of a government, of our society all together. It isn't just one person we can point a finger at. So, you know, I don't really love it. I think a lot of people don't even know what obesity means. I would assume everyone in this room knows.
Guess just overweight, right?
Well, overweight grossly is basically overweight. It's 30% or more of your natural body weight, I believe. Is that right?
Well, it has to do with your BMI, and that has to do with your height and weight. So that's how people determine if you are overweight or not. And it is true that people are stigmatized, but it's something that is a fact in our society that we are not a healthy society.
Jill, when you talk to parents of children who are obese, are they shamed? Do they have that sense of shame that they've done something wrong?
I think they do feel bad. Parents do want to do right by their children, and I think the problem really stems from miseducation. I think that we are grossly we don't really understand what foods that we need to be eating. We're being taught by the government about what foods are proper, and there's a lot of science that isn't being disclosed.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're not being, and I think also there's another element in this. I think that the processed food industry has really learned how to work with our body's senses of what it needs and trick us.
Oh, for sure.
Right, well, 90% of all foods that we're eating are packaged foods.
90%?
90%. Whereas only 1 in 5 children are getting their recommended daily amount of vegetables that they need, and certainly the same for the parents. So only 1 out of 4 parents are having the recommended vegetables. So we're not eating the right foods, and we're eating a lot of the wrong foods, and our bodies cannot metabolize and function with that. And the thing is that the government allows a lot of chemically laden foods that are contributing to the obesity epidemic, cardiovascular disease, and all of our lifestyle diseases, cancer, all these different things.
So we are having problems with obesity in children.
We are, for sure. We are, for sure. And I think a lot of it, you know, even though 90% of these foods are packaged, and I'm not going to say this in terms of what the packaged foods actually do to the body over the long term, but we have the safest food supply in the world,
right?
Hands down, for sure. The USDA and the FDA have
maybe
ensured.
Maybe too safe?
Maybe too safe, because parents trust everything that's on the supermarket shelf. They trust that that's a healthy food for them, that they're not going to get sick, more or less. What we're thinking about in terms of that is they're not going to get sick within the next couple of days. But the reality is, over long term, the foods we're eating are killing us.
So we're having a parent problem here, aren't we?
We are. We're having a parent problem in that, I think Jill's exactly right, our education of what people should eat is not there. I remember going to my doctor 6-7 years ago and telling him what I did. And he said, wow, that's so cool. You know, it's really wild. I've been a doctor for 27 years, and it was about 6 months ago that I went to my first food as medicine conference. And when I was in school, when I was in medical school, we don't even talk about it. Food is not considered medicine or prevention. Mm-hmm. And that's changing. That's changing significantly. And now when you have things endorsed by, you know, doctors and other medical organizations in terms of food being, you know, mm-hmm. preventive medicine, we're making a big turn, you know. So there's a lot of community partners that are now becoming national partners in sponsoring things like, you know, supporting Prop 37 and other things, so we can know what's in our food and we can help families make the right decision.
And with respect to parents, I'd like to pick that up a little bit later, but let's go back to school lunches. I guess we got a break here coming up. But I'd like to ask when we come back from the break about the school lunches that we were feeding before the government stepped in here in 2010 and designed a way of feeding all of the kids. Were we feeding the kids bad foods before then? And are we feeding them good foods now? And what's the difference in that diet that we're working with? Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about school lunches. You know, the government stepped in and mandated a healthy lunch for school children. And yet the school children seem to be throwing this healthy lunch into the garbage. So we're trying to come to grips with the situation, figuring out who should feed the children good food. Should that food program be led by the government, or what happened to the parents in this whole thing? 831-479-1080. Join us if you can. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey, welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. We're talking about feeding the kids healthy food. Who really can feed kids healthy food? That's the subject today. It appears as though somebody was not feeding them healthy foods because so many of them got overweight, obese. And that's just downright dangerous. So we're trying to come to grips, figure out what happened and what the government's response was and whether that's working and where we can go from here. And we have Chef Jamie Smith with us, who is food director of City Schools of Santa Cruz, California. Joe Troder, a nutritionist, holistic nourishing tradition, works with families. So who was feeding all the kids the bad food? Was it just the parents, or were the schools feeding them bad foods as well?
Well, if you listen to the press right now, I mean, obviously I am. I'm feeding the kids all the unhealthy foods. I mean, people are analyzing everything we serve. But I think it's important that everyone kind of understand the history of the National School Lunch Program and where it came from. That's where I started when I didn't know anything about it. I thought, I need to get all the answers and understand where this came from. And, of course, the National School Lunch Program was built to bulk our kids up to be soldiers, you know, from back in the 40s when it was designed to, feed our kids.
You know, I remember about the National School Lunch Program, Wonder Bread.
That's great
stuff. And Wonder Bread fights where you'd knead up the dough and then lob it across.
It's not wonder because it's wonderful. It's wonder because it never gets mold, even after like 6 months. How does it do that?
And, you know, when you look back at the school lunch programs, they were kind of like ways of getting rid of surplus commodities too, right?
No, not exactly. They were ways of supporting our farmers. You know, I mean, the whole concept was that the commodity, and, you know, there are five commodities. There's cotton, soybeans. Cotton's inedible. I mean, that's one of our commodities. It's things that can be siloed. So what would happen is when a farmer would have a banner year, you know, they'd have silos full of stuff, and then the opportunity buyers would buy it because it could be stored, and then next year they'd say, no, we don't need anything. You know, the makers of cornflakes in the 30s or the 20s, right, or whatever, they would say, we bought all your silos from last year, we're good. So then the farmers would have this entire crop of corn that they couldn't sell, and they weren't as good at storing it, but so the government made an opportunity for them to store it and then begin to find ways to distribute it. So those commodities are distributed.
They stored it in school children.
They stored it in foods. And of course, the foods were all whole foods back at that point.
Right,
you know,
right,
I mean,
right.
When we first, say, and even as early as the 70s, butter was a requirement in school meals. You had to serve at least 2 ounces of butter every day. So we were trying to fatten kids up. So it's for government programs, it's changed pretty quick. A lot of people say change has not come fast in the National School Lunch Program, but it changes a lot faster than a lot of other programs. They've, especially with this new Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, they've really listened to the Institute of Medicine, and they've moved really quickly into healthy school meals, culminating with this summer where all of us as food service directors were basically handed the new guidelines with the final, what they call the final rule. And then come September, we needed to open up with them, or July 1st, in fact, if you were open in the summer. So then we have to go online and prove our compliance that we're serving enough fruits and vegetables to all the kids and submit the actual consumption records with the kids after the fact to prove that we've served them healthy lunches.
So when you started feeding the children healthy food, what happened?
Well, I have a good video on one of my websites of a YouTube video that I took of a middle schooler at one of our schools. I'll keep unnamed. And, you know, I was interviewing, you know, hey, how'd you feel when I took chicken nuggets off the menu? And he said, man, that was, well, you can kind of fill in the blanks. BS was effectively his response. But he said, but since you brought us these salad bars and started bringing in all this fresh fruits and vegetables, we're cool now. So actually getting the kids to change is going to take longer than it got us to change the rules and the regs. You know, we're doing it. We've changed our amount of purchasing of fresh fruits and vegetables from, in 08-09, 800 pounds a week to this year we're averaging over 3,000.
Well, so it's a huge, huge difference.
And I'm not buying it to throw it away as much as we're buying it because we're running out. We're buying out because consumption is up. I mean, the fruits and vegetables are things that the kids can choose. We're not force feeding those kids that. Everything that's fruits and vegetables in our schools are offered to them in the salad bars and in fruit baskets full of different fresh fruit. Hey, you know, do you want an apple, an orange, or a banana, or take all three, up to you. And now they feel like what's in the salad bars, what's in the fruit basket is theirs. They used to take the apples and throw them. Custodians are coming up to me and saying, you know, I used to bring a 5-gallon bucket here to pick up all the fruit out in the courtyard and take it home to my pigs, but I don't even bring the bucket anymore because they're eating it all. And it's true. You know, when we gave them ownership and we explained to them that this is theirs, respect it.
So the difference then was between forcing children to eat something.
Yeah.
And allowing them to take responsibility themselves.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know,
same. Jill, how does this ring to you when you're talking with families, individual families, about this notion?
Well, I think that's exactly what the main point is giving children the choice. Children develop what they need to eat as infants. When we tell children that they have to eat certain foods, they have to clear their plate, we're sending them a message that they shouldn't trust themselves. So I think that the children that are rebelling in these schools are not rebelling because of the foods that they're being asked to eat, but they're rebelling because they're being told what to eat. And nobody wants to have that. And so when we're raising a generation of kids and adults who can't trust themselves as animals in the world, that they start to doubt themselves. And that's why we've had a generation or many generations of families, 100 years of people who don't trust themselves. They don't know what to eat biologically. So when we empower the child by giving them choices of offering all these good foods, not chemical foods, not GMO foods, not foods with hydrogenated oils, but if you're providing your family or your children all the good foods to eat, they will biologically choose what they need to eat over the course of a week. And I think the trouble that the schools are having is because they're forcing kids with these calorie restrictions. And where we're focusing only on calories, we're focusing on our fat content, it's missing the bigger picture. It's missing the bigger picture that you're choosing your foods that you need to eat throughout the whole day. And in fact, I think the kids need to eat a bigger meal at lunch and at breakfast and a smaller meal at dinner. And during the course, what I teach, I have a nutrition model called the food tree. And it has 5 food groups on it. And it includes healthy fats. I think this is one of the biggest components that we're missing in our food system is the misinformation about fats and how important fats are in our society. And the government pushes a lot of no fat, fat-free, this and that, but they'll allow fat-free milk with added sugar, I imagine, for their strawberry-flavored milk or chocolate-flavored milk. So again, these are giving kids mixed messages.
They're kind of government-approved additives then in the foods that companies can fight for their right to put things in the foods and lobby the government, and so they kind of find their way into that food chain, and there you are. You know, you brought up a real interesting notion about biological knowledge, that our bodies know intrinsically what we should eat.
Yes.
But when you go out into the world and walk into the convenience stores of life, there are a lot of things that have been packaged, especially to trick that biological sense of what is good for your body, right?
That's right.
And how does one go about teaching children about that?
Well, the truth is you have to teach children from a very young age. And by the age of 3, a lot of their ideas have already been formed about food. And I think what happens is parents themselves don't trust what they need to eat, and then they pass on those fears to the kids. And so you have these generations of people who don't know that. So it's important at a very young age to be enthusiastic about food, to celebrate food, to be grateful, and to talk positively about food. A lot of parents have weight issues, and they talk about dieting and fat-free this, and it's constantly being bombarded to our children about the fear of food, when really we want to be grateful and excited, like what Jamie's doing with the school students. Like now they're excited to eat fresh fruits and vegetables. How wonderful. That's the gift that we want to be giving our kids. So when you provide a huge buffet of beautiful foods, there will be no problems. It's all the junk and the contaminants that our food system is contaminated with.
There you are. So we're on the way here, right?
Making progress.
What about fats, Jamie?
Well, kids need fat. They do. So a lot of times we're taking fats out of things that probably are healthy for kids, but we're using the school meal to offset what's going on outside of school. I mean, these calorie restrictions have been in place for a long time. We haven't been feeding kids too much food in school, hands down, even with these 4 meals a day because the calorie counts are so low. It's what we're trying to offset that they're eating outside of school, where they're consuming 700-800 calories with a soda and a bag of chips after school. That's what we're trying to offset. They get more in that than they get in all the fruits and vegetables I serve every day, hands down.
Wait, we'll talk calories when we come back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. We're feeding the kids good food. And you can help us. We're at 831-479-1080, 479-1080. Pick up your phone. Call us about the kids. Right back. Hey, we're back, and we're having lots of fun talking off the air, so we'll continue that conversation on the air. Let's pick up the notion of fats and calories. We're feeding our kids too many fats and too many calories, and consequently they're getting obese. True or false, Jill?
Well, we need to look at the quality of the fat. If you're feeding kids hydrogenated oil, that is what's contributing to the heart disease and to inflammatory conditions in our society. If you're feeding kids omega-3 fatty acids, you're having unadulterated fats that are not damaged, like a lot of our nut and seed oils become rancid, and that's what's causing a lot of inflammatory issues. So it's really about the quality of the fat that we need to be looking at. And fats are not bad. Fats do not cause us to be fat. In fact, 25 to 30% of our diet should be fats.
Is that probably one of the greatest misconceptions about contemporary nutritional wisdom?
I would say 100%, yes.
Chef Jamie?
Probably. I think there's so many out there now that it would probably be difficult to pinpoint a single one. But that one, hands down, is very true. A lot of folks don't understand that fat is the same thing as sugars and proteins and carbs in terms of calories. And calories are meant to burn energy. So, fats that you eat in a normal and healthy diet are just there for the energy as well, the same burning of calories that you would have from protein. It's just they have more per gram than other things. Now, there's so many new manipulated fats out there through chemical processes that keep food shelf stable. Those are scary to me, because if you can have something put into a food that makes it a recognizable food at first, then becomes something that can sit on the shelf for months, for years,
Twinkies,
at room temperature and not go bad, look, there's no way that your body can do anything with that either. If Mother Nature can't do anything with it outside, there's no way your body magically can do it too. So those are the kind of fats and things that we need to really worry about and take a look at.
Is it easy to get good fats, or is it hard to find good fats, Jill?
It's hard nowadays to find good healthy fats, because what's happening is we need about a 1-to-1 ratio of omega-3s to omega-6 fatty acids. Mm-hmm. And in our society, we're getting about 1-to-20. So we're severely deficient in our omega-3 fatty acids. And the omega-3 fatty acids are fish oils, walnuts, flax, those kind of seeds.
Well, omega-3s, as I understand it, come from green.
Well, in fact, they do. They are made from grasses and algae, mm-hmm. and that's what the animals eat. The fish eat the algae, and then it's a chain, you know, where...
Our ruminants used to eat green things.
Right.
But no longer do.
It's true. They're eating a lot of grain foods, and that's why the animals, if you eat a cow that's pasture-raised on and eating grass-fed foods, then yes, those animals will have a higher content of omega-3s. If you're eating animals that are being fed from feedlots with grains, you're not going to be consuming the amount of omega-3s that your body does need.
Jamie, can you get good fats for the kids? Can you find it?
Yeah, but, you know, sometimes they are a little bit out of our realm. I mean, to add fish oils and things right. like that, I mean, we truly can't afford it. We have tuna sometimes, but it's an expensive. Fish are expensive, and they're not a very sustainable resource at this time. And we could definitely eat all the fish in the sea in a year if everybody decided they were going to stop eating other animals.
And I love similarly with grass-fed beef.
Yeah. I love what she said. If you eat a cow, I love when you
I'm
call
sorry.
It exactly
I know,
what
I'm
it
a
is.
Vegetarian, so that's why
she calls it that. But it's great. I mean, I think it's important that everybody, you know, starts to have a little bit more connection to their food, even in that way. No, mm-hmm. I don't eat cow. I eat beef. You know, come on. Mm-hmm. Same with pork. So it's, you know, that's another simple marketing thing that happened a long time ago. Well, let's not say we're eating cow. Let's say we're eating beef. Beef, it does a body good. Remember that back in the day?
Mm-hmm. Good.
So, yeah, but we do.
Well,
effectively,
and
we almost
with
eliminate
all respects,
fat.
Beef probably does do a body good. When it's raised on grass, as it was meant to be raised, correct?
Sure,
and
but
then you're getting the long chain omega-3s instead of the incredible imbalance. But the way we're raising cheap cow,
yeah, say it, call it like it is.
Yeah, the way we're raising cheap cow leads to that imbalance of fats that we're talking about. So how can you balance get good fats in a school lunch program?
It's not easy, you know, in reality with these calorie counts, we are trying to almost eliminate all fat. I think last year we bought 4 gallons of olive oil and like 6 gallons of canola oil for the entire year because I don't saute anything. I don't stir fry. We basically steam or just dry roast in the oven because we just can't add the calories. If you start adding, well, for example, sugars, carbohydrates, and protein all have 4 calories per gram of carbs mm-hmm. or protein or whatever, and that proteins of course would be beans, beef, all that kind of stuff. Alcohol has, I believe, 7, and then fats have a 9, I think, 9 mm-hmm. or 11 or something like
nine.
That. So they're almost double by weight. So when we start adding little bits of oil here and there to boost our calorie counts, we can go over this limit really quickly. We do it. There are 2 things. This is so funny. They basically want us to eliminate all these things from the school meal, but there's a rule that if you don't meet the calories with all the things that you've put out, whether it's the, you know, whole wheat sandwich with low-fat cheese and low-fat turkey, and then this whole salad bar, if you come under on calorie counts, you're allowed to add sugar or fat to
or
the
Milky
meal.
Milky Way candy bars, right?
Well, you can't do that. Those aren't reimbursable. There's more regs on that. But we would be encouraged to add fat. So we could say, add fat to our refried beans, add a cup of oil and just puree it in, or add oil to our, and they can't be saturated fats. We can't stir butter into a pasta sauce like I did when I was in restaurants. Mm-hmm. But we could add oil and mix it in, which I think is, you know, kind of defeating the purpose.
Jill?
Well, and I'm also wondering if there's, I know that the school system has margarine that they're using. So to me, it's just
not
such
me.
A
that's,
crazy
that's so gross.
Society that we live in, that we're not having beautiful butter that's a whole food that people have been eating for thousands of years, but instead we're having these restrictions of butter and instead putting hydrogenated oil. I don't understand that.
Well, so it doesn't seem as though government has all the answers with respect to what is the proper nutrition. Let's go back to calories and this whole notion of feeding kindergartners 600 calories. What is 600 calories?
A lot for a kindergartner.
I mean, it is?
It's true.
But they only
get
50 more when they get to middle school. And we got kids in 7th and 8th grade that are bigger than me.
Mm-hmm.
And they're playing sports or playing soccer. They need 3,000 calories a day, and we're giving them 650, 700 at lunch, and they maybe don't consume that many decent calories while they're out of school. It's ridiculous.
And they're not
it's
getting those fats.
Ridiculous.
So they're hungry, and they're actually, I mean, what fats do in our bodies, they make you feel satiated, you
yep.
feel warm. Kids will actually eat less long-term if they have those
if
good
they have
quality
the right
fats.
Kinds of food.
But
right?
if you're eliminating an entire food group from our diet, they're not getting those things. And also, let's talk a little bit about eggs. we should be eating whole eggs. When we start taking fats and splitting our foods, we're not getting these whole complex molecules that really do a lot together in the body.
And so are we actually doing that? Are we using powdered eggs?
No. We use whole eggs in all applications, whether we put them in salads, you know, hard-boiled eggs, or eggs are great. You know, they're great. They don't have that many calories, actually. I think an egg has 90 calories, maybe, or 70, something like that. So it's not super heavy, but it's got lots of great protein in it.
So is it really a problem, Chef Jamie Smith, that we're feeding children too many calories? I mean, are we going to reduce obesity simply by reducing calories?
No.
I think the vote is in on that.
Okay,
one.
I guess we have
a
consensus there.
We're going to make people more sick. Yeah, they're going to be hungry. They're not going to be satiated, exactly as Jill said. And they're not going to be getting a good balance of foods that's going to make them want to go outside and do something. So they're just going to sit on the couch, and they may not be as obese, but they're going to be extremely unhealthy.
So what the heck is healthy food when we come back? This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson here. What do you feed your kids? What kind of healthy food do you feed them? Is it healthy? This is the Food Chain, 831-479-1080. Right back. Hey, we're back on the Food Chain. It's Michael Olson here. Today we're talking feeding the children with Chef Jamie Smith, food director of Santa Cruz City Schools, California, Jill Troderman, nutritionist, holistic nourishing nutrition, and you. So we're off the mic, we got into this wonderful conversation about how we feed kids and their reaction to how we feed kids. And Chef Jamie was talking about these incredible regulations. He said, what did you do when you first got the regulations for the new food guidelines in your hand?
I felt like I'd been kind of tied up at the chest. Like, I couldn't breathe. It was so confounding to what I was brought up doing with my own family and also learning to be a chef. It was so contradictory to the way I thought we should be doing this thing,
in
the way
what
we should
respect?
Be approaching it. The regulations on measuring everything and having to break down all these different vegetable subgroups and make sure that you are getting a certain eighth of a cup of this here and an eighth of a cup of that there, but then the calorie counts couldn't exceed this amount, and you can't do this and you can't do that, but wait, why can't I put carrots in my spaghetti sauce? Well, the carrots won't count as a vegetable if you put them in the spaghetti sauce. Everything has to be separated, and, you know, it was just overwhelming. I mean, we've always done the trick that all moms do, and they puree vegetables into sauces and stuff. In the new regs, those were not going to count. They actually did change it and amend that rule, so in certain applications, you can puree carrots and onions into your spaghetti sauce, like I've done as an Italian chef for my whole career. But those initially weren't going to count. Only the tomato sauce would count. That whole exception came from the lobbyists from the pizza industry that wanted to make sure that pizza remained a vegetable. I think everybody remembers that controversy, yeah. But it's the tomato paste on the pizza. So I took a little break and then came back. And our biggest effort over, you know, July and August, once we got the new regulations, was to figure out new recipes that would meet the new regulations, be compliant, as we say, but would not affect the end-use customer, that the service, that the meal appearance would be exactly the same and appealing.
Jill, what about how we feed children, presentation?
I think they are very perceptive. And I think when children are taught that food is a wonderful expression of our life on Earth and that there's abundance and it's good for them, that they're going to have a really good attitude towards it, I think that these things come from parents. I think that the way parents are teaching their children about food really plays an amazing part in how kids are approaching food when they get to the school system and if they're amenable to these new changes that are happening.
What happened when you commissioned a study?
This is an interesting, kind of development in the way we were looking at the school food. Basically, to be super compliant, make sure that you have all your bases covered.
Super compliant.
Super compliant is when you come
and
get an audit.
I never had that problem in my life. being super
we
compliant.
In food service directors, especially in large school systems, are attempting to be super compliant. And the easiest way to do that is to buy pre-made processed foods where they have a thing on them called a CN label.
Oh.
That means that when your inspector comes and scans it, that you're automatically compliant as long as a kid took it. But there's no attachment to what's in the food whatsoever. So at one of our schools, we have one of these supper programs, and we decided that we were going to start serving the same meal. And it's the same kids, usually, because they're usually the kids that get school lunch that are in this after-school program. We didn't serve the same meal on the same day, but we served the lunch entree from, say, 2 weeks ahead or a week behind at supper. And then we wanted to measure what we call the acceptability factor, the consumption rate, what they threw away, the thing you were referring to right at the beginning, how much of the food gets thrown away. We served them the portioned meal at lunch, measured how much of it they ate. The super compliant portions, and the amounts of fruits and vegetables that they took off the salad bar and actually ate. And then we made the meal family style, where everything is served out of chafing dishes and hotel pans, like a tamale pie that's actually just served. And even better, we let the students prepare the meal. So the students actually came in, cooked the tamale pie in the oven at the school, they made the salad, they put out the milk, and we had one student serving his classmates each of the components of the meal, the milk, the salad. Hey, you know, come try my oranges. They're the sweetest ever. Every kid took everything we served when we served it that way, when the kids were vested in the end product, even though I'd made the same entree. We just put it in a different vessel. And so we were talking about 59% of the food was consumed that was actually taken out to the cafeteria versus 93%. That's 93% was consumed. So I don't even know what the factor is, but it's such a significant factor in terms of statistics that it was off the charts. It was like a one, which is, if you know anything about statistics, it's ultra significant. Super compliant to ultra significant.
Wow.
And they know about these things with the farm-to-table programs, that when children are growing their food, when they know where the food is coming from, when they know what a broccoli plant looks like or where a raspberry comes from, they're more inclined to eat these things. And then when they have that beautiful ownership of cooking a meal and then sharing it with their friends, this is hitting on all the different aspects of our humanity. This is our consciousness, our social skills, our intelligence, the science base of nutrients. So it's hitting all these things, and that's really how to have great success with feeding our children, is to have them being empowered, basically, and being educated.
And now we have a question from Dan, who wants to know about GMOs, right, Dan?
Yes, sir.
What do you want to know?
Well, let me say I'm a substitute teacher in County of Santa Cruz, and Chef Jamie Smith, it started before you came, but you've done a stellar job at improving the meals. I see it.
Thank you.
Yes, and let me guess, are both Chef Jamie and Jill members of the Weston A. Price Foundation?
I'm not an actual member, but
I am well-versed in their theory.
Dan, can you hold on? We're going to take a quick break. Folks, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. We will be right back after this. And I think we're going to talk a little bit about GMOs, but we're going to ask the big question, which to me is, what role parents have to play in the feeding of their children? Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, we have so much to talk about and so little time to talk about it, but we're going to pick up. Dan, you have a question with respect to GMOs in kids' food, right?
Well, not a question, a comment.
A comment.
I notice there's a high prevalence of corn, and I assume corn oil, canola oil, cottonseed oil, all of that is likely to be GMO. It's no darn good. And unless we address this, the kids are doomed in spite of the progress we've been making. I'd just like to announce that GMO Free Santa Cruz is going to have their final march.
Dan, this is not the place for that. Thank you, though, for the attempt. So, with respect to GMOs, and California has Proposition 37. Which, of course, would require the labeling of genetically modified foods. And probably kids are getting genetically modified foods vis-a-vis the corn oil, the corn meal, and probably anything made of soy. So what do you two think? Should Californians vote yes on Proposition 37? Jill?
Of course.
Yes.
Okay.
Without a doubt.
Without a doubt.
If GMOs were so great, they should be splashing them all over the labels. So that's not the case.
Yeah, that's pretty obvious. So the, you know, the studies haven't been done to know for sure that the long-term effects of genetically modified organisms in our food are unhealthy. That's not been done. It hasn't had its Earth Day yet, as Michael Pollan says. But this is a much bigger issue than that. This is an issue of just a citizen knowing what's in their food, what's being fed to them. It's only a label, and I completely agree. If it's totally fine, broadcast it. Put it out there. Say, this is the future, and this is what GMOs were designed to do, they say. GMOs were designed to make us able to feed the entire world on a shoestring. And, you know, so we want to see that.
Do you see any benefit for the consumers of GMOs as for school children? Are school children getting any benefit from GMO foods?
Not at this point. If they're labeled and the science comes out to be beneficial in the end after a long-term study, then we'll be able to answer to that. But at this point, I think the most important thing for people to know is that they should vote yes on Prop 37 so that they can know this is a rare opportunity in any political movement to have a game-changing vote out there. This is one that can actually change the face of food in this
and
country.
For all of you listening across the land, coming to a state near you soon too.
Yeah, because they're not going to make different food for California.
So let me ask you the thing: the beaver that's gnawing on my leg is the fact of parents and parents abdicating their responsibility to the government to feed their children. And you know, Jill, you talked about it earlier. The parents don't know, and they have a generational knowledge of how to do things poorly, and yet if we as turn this over to the government, do not we perpetuate that lack of knowledge? And do we not? I can't think of a simpler, more effective way to destroy the family than to force parents to abdicate the responsibility for feeding their children. Am I wrong?
Agreed. The parents need to take full responsibility for feeding their kids. They need to be authoritative, not authoritarian, which is what our school system might be doing, not in Jamie's case, but when we're forcing kids, telling them what they need to be eating and having these calorie restrictions, even though they're getting plenty of calories, but it's the institutionalization of our food that's a problem. But parents need to be firm. They need to set their rules, and they can't be too permissive with what is being allowed. And I think the food that we have is too permissive.
Jamie?
Our society is dying due to the elimination of the family supper table, hands down.
Out of time. Folks, thank you so much. And remember, go out and find some food with this farmer's face on it and live. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.